Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de la región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Inglés. Nivel C2. Convocatoria ordinaria 2023. Comprensión de textos orales.
Task 1. Please read the instructions and the task.
Example.
Okay, so welcome everybody to this webinar today. My name is Tracy Stanley. I'm Director of Library Services at Cardiff University, and I'm going to be hosting the session today. This is part of the Vice-Chancellor's series of anti-racism talks. Michelle Alexis, who is Chair of our Race Equality Steering Group, is leading these on behalf of the university, and this is a series of events which will run for 2 years and cover a range of different disciplines.
Extract number one.
Sometimes when you go back to watch an older movie you love, it feels a little bit off. Like, ugh, this hasn't aged well. University of Chicago film professor Jacqueline Stewart had that feeling with Purple Rain, starring the one and only Prince. Purple Rain.
It's a musical that I adore. It's also a film that features a scene where a woman's thrown into a garbage dumpster.
Incredible artistry, undercurrents of misogyny. Unpacking those mixed feelings is what Jacqueline Stewart does as one of the hosts for the Turner Classic Movies channel in a new series called TCM.
Extract number two.
Last Thursday, I was in Galway at the Irish MedTech Annual Conference. It's a really important sector in the country, with 25,000 people directly employed in it, some big multinational companies, but also lots of Irish indigenous firms who have done extraordinarily well in developing very modern, innovative products and services. At the event, one of the people I interviewed was the chief executive of IBEC, Danny McCoy, and I was taken by how positive he was about the Irish economy and its prospects. And this was even a day before the deal.
Extract number three.
So we always start by asking, what's your mix?
I'm South African Australian. So my dad's a black South African from Cape Town, and my mom's an Anglo-Australian of Irish and Scottish descent.
How did your dad get to Australia?
He came by boat. So he's a boat person, loud and proud. But he came as soon as the white Australia policy was lifted for people migrating in, which I think was 1973, I think.
And so apartheid in South Africa was still in full swing?
Heavy.
Extract number 4.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Love Scotland. Today I'm at the Georgian House in Edinburgh to visit an exhibition about the life and legacy of a man who helped shape the city's musical landscape. Felix Janowicz's name may not be familiar, but the Polish-Lithuanian composer and musician was a key player in the Georgian concert halls of the late 1700s. He'd fled revolution and political upheaval in Europe and had arrived in Britain as a young musician determined to prove himself. His career quickly took off, and Felix earned a keen following for his...
Extract number 5.
Today, we're going to dig into the history of the Aboriginal people of this island, Australia, and the pre-colonial years. Now, remember that this covers an estimated 65,000 years of time, but please note that the stories about Aboriginal culture before the mid-1700s, which is what we're discussing, it was an oral history, which means it was passed down verbally, or through song, through story, through from generation to generation, and coupled with the dark realities of colonisation and its near annihilation of these people altogether, this means that stitching the episode together was not easy. There's a-
Extract number 6.
Is East Asia facing a climbing debt crisis? Yesterday on Business Daily, we heard from a couple of problem debtors in the United States, but maybe it's in Asia where the biggest problems are currently presenting themselves. Here are a couple of numbers for you. Consumer lending in China has trebled in just the last decade. It now totals more than half of the nation's annual income, and it's even higher in neighbouring countries like Malaysia, Thailand and South Korea. The problem here isn't just the levels of indebtedness, but it's the speed of change and the question whether ordinary citizens are able to cope with the problems that so much debt can sometimes lead to.
Extract number 7.
Okay, so if you are still searching for last-minute gift ideas for the film enthusiast in your life, no need to panic. We've got film critic Kenneth Turan here with a couple of new box sets that bring some classic films together for the very first time. Great gift ideas. Kenny, good morning to you.
Morning, David.
So let's talk about this first box set. Sounds like it brings a bunch of films together from a maestro of Italian cinema. Tell me what we're talking about.
Extract number 8.
Rewilding is one of those slightly problematic terms that means different things to different people. It's a term which is, to be honest, evolving. Peter Cairns is the executive director of Scotland The Big Picture, an organisation which supports rewilding in this country. Now, I met up with them recently, close to the River Feshie near Kincraig, and as we wandered along the riverbank, Peter...
Example.
Okay, so welcome everybody to this webinar today. My name is Tracy Stanley. I'm Director of Library Services at Cardiff University, and I'm going to be hosting the session today. This is part of the Vice-Chancellor's series of anti-racism talks. Michelle Alexis, who is Chair of our Race Equality Steering Group, is leading these on behalf of the university. And this is a series of events which will run for 2 years and cover a range of different disciplines.
Extract number one.
Sometimes when you go back to watch an older movie you love, it feels a little bit off, like, ugh, this hasn't aged well. The University of Chicago film professor Jacqueline Stewart had that feeling with Purple Rain, starring the one and only Prince. Purple Rain.
It's a musical that I adore. It's also a film that features a scene where a woman's thrown into a garbage dumpster.
Incredible artistry, undercurrents of misogyny. Unpacking those mixed feelings is what Jacqueline Stewart does as one of the hosts for the Turner Classic Movies channel in a new series called TCM.
Extract number two.
Last Thursday, I was in Galway at the Irish MedTech Annual Conference. It's a really important sector in the country, with 25,000 people directly employed in it, some big multinational companies, but also lots of Irish indigenous firms who have done extraordinarily well in developing very modern, innovative products and services. At the event, one of the people I interviewed was the chief executive of IBEC, Danny McCoy, and I was taken by how positive he was about the Irish economy and its prospects. And this was even a day before the deal.
Extract number three.
So we always start by asking, what's your mix?
I'm South African Australian. So my dad's a black South African from Cape Town, and my mum's an Anglo-Australian of Irish and Scottish descent.
How did your dad get to Australia?
He came by boat. So he's a boat person, loud and proud. But he came as soon as the white Australia policy was lifted for people migrating in, which I think was 1973, I think.
And so apartheid in South Africa was still in full swing? Heavy.
Extract number four.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Love Scotland. Today I'm at the Georgian House in Edinburgh to visit an exhibition about the life and legacy of a man who helped shape the city's musical landscape. Felix Janowicz's name may not be familiar, but the Polish-Lithuanian composer and musician was a key player in the Georgian concert halls of the late 1700s. He'd fled revolution and political upheaval in Europe and had arrived in Britain as a young musician determined to prove himself. His career quickly took off, and Felix earned a keen following for his...
Extract number five.
Today, we're going to dig into the history of the Aboriginal people of this island, Australia, and the pre-colonial years. Now, remember that this covers an estimated 65,000 years of time, but please note that the stories about Aboriginal culture before the mid-1700s, which is what we're discussing, it was an oral history, which means it was passed down verbally or through song, through story, through from generation to generation, and coupled with the dark realities of colonization and its near annihilation of these people altogether, this means that stitching the episode together was not easy. There's a...
Extract number six.
Is East Asia facing a climbing debt crisis? Yesterday on Business Daily, we heard from a couple of problem debtors in the United States, but maybe it's in Asia where the biggest problems are currently presenting themselves. Here are a couple of numbers for you. Consumer lending in China has trebled in just the last decade. It now totals more than half of the nation's annual income, and it's even higher in neighboring countries like Malaysia, Thailand, and South Korea. The problem here isn't just the levels of indebtedness, but it's the speed of change and the question whether ordinary citizens are able to cope with the problems that so much debt can sometimes lead to.
Extract number seven.
Okay, so if you are still searching for last-minute gift ideas for the film enthusiast in your life, No need to panic. We've got film critic Kenneth Turan here with a couple of new box sets that bring some classic films together for the very first time. Great gift ideas. Kenny, good morning to you.
Morning, David.
So let's talk about this first box set. It sounds like it brings a bunch of films together from a maestro of Italian cinema. Tell me what we're talking about.
Extract number 8.
Rewelding is one of those slightly problematic terms that means different things to different people. It's a term which is, to be honest, evolving. Peter Cairns is the executive director of Scotland The Big Picture, an organisation which supports rewelding in this country. Now, I met up with them recently, close to the River Feshie near Kincraig. And as we wandered along the riverbank, Peter
Task 2. Please read the instructions and the task.
In a darkened room in a laboratory in London, a group of students and researchers watch a clump of human brain cells settle into their new home, a living mouse brain. On a computer monitor next to a microscope, the human cells light up in flashes of simultaneous activity. Over time, the cells sprout new connections a few centimeters long and form networks with each other. It's captivating viewing for his students, says Vincenzo De Paola, who runs the lab at Imperial College London. It's all they want to do. I can't tear them away, he says. They have front row seats to an unusual show. De Paola's group is one of just a handful of labs able to study human neural cells at work in a live, developing brain, a system that is otherwise largely off-limits for both ethical and technical reasons. We cannot study these processes as they unfold in a fetal human brain, De Paola says. Instead, we want to watch human cortical neurons mature and form active networks in a live animal, he says. De Paola's system is a specialized type of neural chimera, an area of research that has expanded immensely in the past 5 years, sparking a debate about the ethics of blending human and animal brain tissue. Proponents say that such systems are necessary to manipulate live human neurons and are already yielding important insights into health and disease. For example, using neural chimeras, scientists have found differences in how neurons develop and behave in Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease. But others warn that such chimeras represent an ethical grey zone because of the potential to blur the line between humans and other animals, or to recapitulate human-like perception or cognition in an animal. Some researchers say these kinds of chimeras should only be used if no other cell or animal model is appropriate. Quote, is this a really good model for answering a scientific question, or are we pushing boundaries for the sake of it? Asks Naomi Morris, a developmental biologist at the Francis Crick Institute in London. Ethicists are asking at what point a collection of human neurons in another animal's brain embodies something that deserves a unique moral status. Although research using chimeras, entities made up of cells from different organisms or species, has been going on for decades, these neural chimeras broach new ethical territory. A 2021 special report on neural chimera research by the US National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine flagged issues such as the possibility of endowing animals with new cognitive abilities or human disease symptoms that could be distressing. The committee advised that although current regulation of stem cell and animal research was adequate, the field should be kept under close surveillance. The committee also encouraged the use of pilot studies and close monitoring of animals to identify any new or unusual behaviours. There will be plenty for regulators to keep an eye on. Researchers are starting to consider going beyond transplanting a few isolated cells to create... In a darkened room in a laboratory in London, a group of students and researchers watch a clump of human brain cells settle into their new home, a living mouse brain. On a computer monitor next to a microscope, the human cells light up in flashes of simultaneous activity. Over time, the cells sprout new connections a few centimeters long and form networks with each other. It's captivating viewing for his students, says Vincenzo De Paola, who runs the lab at Imperial College London. It's all they want to do. I can't tear them away, he says. They have front row seats to an unusual show. De Paola's group is one of just a handful of labs able to study human neural cells at work in a live developing brain, a system that is otherwise largely off limits for both ethical and technical reasons. We cannot study these processes as they unfold in a fetal human brain, De Paola says. Instead, we want to watch human cortical neurons mature and form active networks in a live animal, he says. De Paola's system is a specialized type of neural chimera, an area of research that has expanded immensely in the past 5 years, sparking a debate about the ethics of blending human and animal brain tissue. Proponents say that such systems are necessary to manipulate live human neurons and are already yielding important insights into health and disease. For example, using neural chimeras, scientists have found differences in how neurons develop and behave in Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease. But others warn that such chimeras represent an ethical grey zone because of the potential to blur the line between humans and other animals, or to recapitulate human-like perception or cognition in an animal. Some researchers say these kinds of chimeras should only be used if no other cell or animal model is appropriate. Quote, is this a really good model for answering a scientific question, or are we pushing boundaries for the sake of it? Asks Naomi Morris, a developmental biologist at the Francis Crick Institute in London. Ethicists are asking at what point a collection of human neurons in another animal's brain embodies something that deserves a unique moral status. Although research using chimeras, entities made up of cells from different organisms or species, has been going on for decades, these neural chimeras broach new ethical territory. A 2021 special report on neural chimera research by the US National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine flagged issues such as the possibility of endowing animals with new cognitive abilities or human disease symptoms that could be distressing. The committee advised that although current regulation of stem cell and animal research was adequate, the field should be kept under close surveillance. The committee also encouraged the use of pilot studies and close monitoring of animals to identify any new or unusual behaviours. There will be plenty for regulators to keep an eye on. Researchers are starting to consider going beyond transplanting a few isolated cells to create...
Task 3. Please read the instructions and the task.
It was 1976. An Irish kid named Paul Hewson was trying to figure a lot of things out. His mom had died a couple years earlier when he was just 14. Bono, as he was known, spent a lot of time at home in Dublin arguing with his dad and his older brother. But two goals kept him focused: to win over the heart of a girl named Alison Stewart and to become a rock star. And in the same week, both things happened. He asked Alison out, and she said yes, and he ended up in Larry Mullen's kitchen for an audition. Two other guys were there, Adam Clayton and David Evans, also known as The Edge. The four of them would go on to become one of the biggest bands of their time, U2. And by the way, Bono is still married to Alison Stewart 40 years later.
I wonder if sometimes we do have what we need around us that's there. I certainly felt and have continually felt that the people I need are right there.
Bono writes about these foundational relationships in his new memoir called Surrender, 40 Songs, One Story. I wanted to focus on another constant in his life that's central to the book, his faith. He was never a mass on Sundays kind of Catholic, but from a young age, Bono was fascinated with mysticism and ritual and Jesus.
You write in the book, "If I was in a cafe right now and someone said, 'Stand up if you're ready to give your life to Jesus,' I'd be the first to my feet."
Yeah.
Did your band share your focus, your preoccupation with faith?
They still do. At first, Adam was just like, oh, man. He had just one thing in life, just wants to be in like the badass rock and roll band. And like, oh my God, he won't write songs about girls. He's writing songs, oh God. But he stood by me, you know, and stood by us in our devotion. You know, I mean, could you imagine Ireland in the 70s? It's a civil war, all but a civil war. The country's dividing along sectarian lines. I know, I was very suspicious and still am a little suspicious of religious people. I mean, religion is often a club that people use to beat someone else over the head with. And we learned that. I learned that at a very early age in Ireland.
You write that a lot of U2's music, though, is grounded in the feeling, the emotion, even the structure of a hymn.
Yeah, Edge's family were Welsh. If you've never heard crowds singing at a Welsh-Irish rugby match, the stadium filled with song, and they sing these huge hymns. You know, bread of heaven, God made to like that, we'll support you evermore. And it's in him, it's in Edge, those fifths. And that's the feeling we've been looking for in our music. Yes, we want punk rock, we want it to be brutal, we want it to be tough-minded, we want it to have big tunes. But the ecstatic music is sort of part of who we are.
After 40 years of selling out arenas as a musician, trying to eradicate hunger and AIDS as an activist, Bono is ready to admit he hasn't gotten it all right. And the Dublin kid who's always been the big voice at the center is ready to hear what others have to say.
Just shut up and listen is kind of where I'm at the moment. I just need to be more silent and to surrender to my band. It's been at the core of what I'm trying to do with my life, surrender to my wife. And when I say surrender totally, I do not mean.
It was 1976. An Irish kid named Paul Hewson was trying to figure a lot of things out. His mom had died a couple years earlier when he was just 14. Bono, as he was known, spent a lot of time at home in Dublin arguing with his dad and his older brother. But two goals kept him focused: to win over the heart of a girl named Alison Stewart and to become a rock star. And in the same week, both things happened. He asked Alison out and she said yes. And he ended up in Larry Mullen's kitchen for an audition. Two other guys were there, Adam Clayton and David Evans, also known as The Edge. The four of them would go on to become one of the biggest bands of their time, U2. And by the way, Bono is still married to Alison Stewart 40 years later.
I wonder if sometimes we do have what we need around us that's there. I certainly felt and have continually felt that the people I need are right there.
Bono writes about these foundational relationships in his new memoir called Surrender, 40 Songs, One Story. I wanted to focus on another constant in his life that's central to the book, his faith. He was never a mass on Sundays kind of Catholic, but from a young age, Bono was fascinated with mysticism and ritual and Jesus. You write in the book, "If I was in a cafe right now and someone said, 'Stand up if you're ready to give your life to Jesus,' I'd be the first to my feet."
Yeah.
Did your band share your focus, your preoccupation with faith?
They still do. At first, Adam was just like, oh, man. He had just one thing in life, just wants to be in like the badass rock and roll band. And like, oh my God, he won't write songs about girls. He's writing songs, oh God. But he stood by me, you know, and stood by us in our devotion. You know, I mean, could you imagine Ireland in the 70s? It's a civil war, all but a civil war. The country's dividing along sectarian lines. I know, I was very suspicious and still am a little suspicious of religious people. I mean, religion is often a club that people use to beat someone else over the head with. And we learned that. I learned that at a very early age in Ireland.
You write that a lot of U2's music, though, is grounded in the feeling, the emotion, even the structure of a hymn.
Yeah, Edge's family were Welsh. If you've never heard crowds singing at a Welsh-Irish rugby match, the stadium filled with song, and they sing these huge hymns. You know, bread of heaven, God made to lie down, we'll support you evermore. And it's in him, it's in Edge, those fifths. And that's the feeling we've been looking for in our music. Yes, we want punk rock, we want it to be brutal, we want it to be tough-minded, we want it to have big tunes. But the ecstatic music is sort of part of who we are.
After 40 years of selling out arenas as a musician, trying to eradicate hunger and AIDS as an activist, Bono is ready to admit he hasn't gotten it all right. And the Dublin kid who's always been the big voice at the center is ready to hear what others have to say.
Just shut up and listen is kind of where I'm at the moment. I just need to be more silent and to surrender to my band. It's been at the core of what I'm trying to do with my life, surrender to my wife. And when I say surrender totally, I do not mean.
Fin de la prueba.